We'll see how it goes.
I'm recording, but we can.
Okay. Hello, guys, gals, non-binary pals, convention goers, and others. I'm your host, Harper, and today we have a special guest with us, and her name is...
Hi, guys. I'm Jessica.
And Jessica joined me to go to the fantastic Blacktasticon in June. It's been a couple weeks, and we're just now sitting down to talk about it. It was June 16th and 17th.
Just took a long time to process.
It did take a long time to process and to figure out how to record and edit and do all sorts of things because DJ is not here with us. DJ is on summer break. And I am incapable of functioning without DJ, apparently.
I'm a guest. I don't have any actual responsibilities.
So before we begin, do you want to just tell us a little bit about yourself? No? Okay.
I'm just kidding.
I was going to say, I'll tell you guys about her then. She is very kind. She's a math major.
And a science fiction studies minor, which is like my pride and joy right there. Brings me much happiness.
It's more than what I have. I have no minor.
And I get to do really cool research. I get to do science fiction research, which is lots of fun.
That is.
I get paid to read.
Nice.
It's the life.
So I'm going to just consider you an expert then, if you do science fiction research.
Can we not?
And all I have behind me is a couple glasses.
It's okay. You're the real expert. You're the real literature major. So.
Oh, no. I do not want expert attached anywhere near my name when we talk about this, because
true.
I am not an expert in anything, really.
But we're expert readers. And we're expert fun havers.
I'm an expert in going to college forever and never getting a degree. I'm okay with that title.
See, when family comes over, I'm just like, you're a senior now. And I'm like, yeah.
For the next 4 years.
Yeah.
Okay, before we get too off topic, I'm just going to read a couple lines from the Blacktasticon website so that you guys know what it was. It was a convention for Black science fiction and speculative fiction. So on the website, it says that it is a celebration of the Black fantastic. It is to bring attention to their work and the work of other indie Black speculative fiction creators. And I think it does that. I think it does it
absolutely.
Well. It was very exciting.
But like the whole time I was like, how have I never heard of any of these people before?
I know, because like, they're incredible.
And all of their magical incredibleness.
I mean, both of us read the graphic novel adaptation of Octavia E. Butler's Kindred the night before the con, because, as you'll hear later in this episode, we interviewed John Jennings, who was the artist for the graphic novel.
And he's like an impressive human being.
He is a very impressive human being. He, alongside Linda D. Addison, both are winners of the Bram Stoker Award for horror. That's impressive.
That's
super impressive.
Yeah.
I do not read a lot of horror, and as we discussed with John, and you'll hear it later, I didn't realize that Kindred was considered horror, but I'm so happy for him and his co-author, Damian Duffy. So Damian Duffy and John Jennings both did the graphic novel adaptation of Kindred.
With an introduction by Nnedi Okorafor, which is super cool.
It is.
She's also super awesome.
I know. I kind of wish she'd been there.
Oh my gosh, that would have been really cool.
I would have fangirled.
Kind of did fangirl with Linda Addison, though.
You did. You hardcore did.
Oh, she's a math major, and that's the coolest thing ever.
Sure. I'm not a math major.
Just give me this, okay?
But I used to be a physics major. It's close.
She started as a physics major.
Okay, yeah. So I'd never been to a convention. You'd never been to a convention. So general setup, they had an opening ceremony. They had presentations. They had panels. They had a round table to end everything on Sunday. They had vendors set up in one of the ballrooms.
And they were all the sweetest people.
Everyone there. Yeah. I didn't meet a single person that I disliked. I mean,
oh my gosh, they're all so sweet.
The kindest, most creative group of people I think I've ever met.
And so welcoming.
Yeah.
It was so nice to just
the feel artist.
Like, yeah. Oh my gosh. Everyone is so jealous of the art I bought.
Marshall. Mm-hmm. I can't think of the full
Lakes.
Name. Marshall Lakes. Yes, we both bought art from Marshall Lakes. Yeah.
You got prints, and I got a print, and Prince T.S., and I got a print of Prince, and an original, and I got to see Incredibles 2 this weekend, so it was like...
Because your original was Frozone.
Frozone with a purple lightsaber.
Okay. Nice.
It was magic.
I got a Spider-Man print, and a Lando Calrissian print.
Very cool.
It was very cool. So we had vendors, panels, presentations... There was a cosplay event. There was supposed to be a masquerade ball, but unfortunately it got canceled last minute due to the location, issues with the location. This was all hosted on the Georgia Tech campus, other than the would have been masquerade ball would have been in a library in Atlanta that I can't think of the name of. But I want to say it was called Sweet Auburn or something.
Something like that, yeah.
So it was really cool to have it on Georgia Tech campus, but I'm not sure the attendees agreed.
Because there was no food.
There was no food. Nothing is open on campus in the summertime.
Especially not on a weekend.
Not on the weekend. And so the only food was like a mile walk in the...
Yeah, no, Dr. Yasek said it was like 5 minute walk. No.
I've never even been there and I know it's not 5 minutes.
It was a 15 minute walk.
Because it takes 10 minutes to get to the student center stamps area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it was a 15 minute walk, and I showed someone the way, and we were both dripping in sweat by the end of it, and he was like, wow, that was way more than 5 minutes. And I was like, yeah, I tried to warn you, I'm really sorry.
Most of us survived off of vending machine goods.
Yes, thank you, vending machines with debit card readers.
So we went to the opening ceremony. Mm-hmm. It was short and sweet, introduced the main players, special guests. Guests of honor, kind of set the feel for the whole day. It was just an upbeat, excited little opening ceremony. And then I think it started immediately going into panels, which we missed the first panel in order to interview John Jennings.
Worth it.
Of course it was worth it. That was fantastic. And as I said, you'll hear his interview in just a little bit. But so... Our first panel of the day that we went to was called Pattern Master, The Legacy of Octavia E. Butler. I think you've read more.
By one book. More okay. By one
so
book.
So what have you read?
I read Fledgling, which apparently I was informed at the panel that that was her fun book. That was the book she wrote for fun. And if anybody has read Fledgling, that book... It's not fun. it's so Octavia Butler, and it's so like psychologically just perplexing, but it is really entertaining. You'll hear in the interview I'm talking with John Jennings about it, and I was literally up for hours until like 5 a.m. reading it because it was so good, but it's also so disturbing. Kind of like Kindred.
I was gonna say, I get the sense that all of Octavia E. Butler's works were disturbing in some way or another.
Yeah.
I think the main thing I took from the panel was just the absolute awe, respect, and love for Octavia E. Butler from not only the authors on the panel, but
anyone who reads her,
but also just the people in the audience. Everyone had their own little story to share, like how they had connected with her works and how it had made them think about something or helped them in some way. And as someone who had only read that graphic novel adaptation and nothing else by Octavia E. Butler, I had no clue. And so it was a whole new world for me, but it was eye-opening. Like, mm-hmm. I felt connected to these people, even though I'd only read one work, but I could understand their amazement with her.
Yeah.
Because her writing is phenomenal.
Yeah. And within a couple days of the con, she was actually the Google Doodle of the day because it was her birthday. And I posted on Facebook about her and I was just like, it was such a great experience. And then, like, she's, like, I feel like she's starting to gain momentum more and more and more, and she deserves it. It just sucks she's not around to see it.
Yeah.
Honestly, I'm still just flabbergasted that Fledgling was her fun novel. And, like, if you talk to someone who's read more than just two books from her, or if you've read more than two books from her, you know it is her fun novel. Because, comparatively speaking, it is fun. It's about vampires. Who doesn't love vampires? But, oh my gosh. I was sitting next to my professor. I read Fledgling for class, for my Afrofuturism science fiction class. We had some intense conversations in class about, like, perceptions of the main character and her age versus her actual age and, like, all the weird things that happen. And we're just like, this is low-key pedophilia. Like, this is creepy and weird and disturbing.
Are you sure you're not talking about Twilight?
And it's her fun novel. It's so much better than Twilight.
I know, but I'm just saying, kind of pedophilia, vampires.
No, but, okay, so the main character, she's like 40 or 50, but she looks like a 12-year-old black girl, little black girl.
Okay.
But she's actually 40 or 50. She's the first black vampire of her, like, Ina is their species. She's the first black one. And she's the only one who can even stay awake when the sun is up. She's the only one, she can stay awake, and she's the therefore the only one that can actually go out into the sun without, like, dying. Mm. And, like, that's a big deal, but racism holds them back because people are trying to kill her because she's black.
Okay.
But the creepy part about the pedophilia is that she's outwardly looks like a 12-year-old girl, and this 30-year-old dude picks her up off the side of the road, and she, like, he tries to, something happens, I don't remember exactly what, because it's been a while since I've read it, but she bites him, and so, like, biting helps her take control of, like, the human whatever, and he starts to like it. And it's so creepy, because this 30-year-old dude, 20, 30-year-old dude just picks up a little 12-year-old girl off the road.
Yeah.
It's creepy.
I can see how that's weird. Problematic.
Yeah. Having read things like Carmilla, I knew what was happening, but, like, at the same time, it's just like, this is not okay.
Yeah. So this panel, I'm just gonna list off some of the people who were on it. So Linda D. Addison, Valjean Jeffers, Cherie Thomas, Troy Wiggins, Kenesha Will. I think that was everybody that I can remember. But, I mean, that's, like, an established panel of
really impressive human beings.
Yeah. And what got me was, I mean, I already mentioned that they were, like, so in awe, and they spoke mm-hmm. of their love for her, but it was, they are all extremely successful, impressive people mm-hmm. who just
turn into little fangirls when it comes to Octavia Butler. Not literally anybody listening. I'm joking. Please don't be offended.
But I just meant they were so humble.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
In the discussion of someone who's a hero to them.
Yeah.
And so,
and it wasn't just the women either. It was everyone.
I mean, it just made you feel that awe mm-hmm. because this established group of really, really impressive authors and editors made it seem like they were just normal, everyday people mm-hmm. discussing their favorite author.
Which was so cool.
It was very cool.
Because you go up to them and you're like, you're so cool, and they're just like, yeah, okay. I believe you.
As nice as everyone was, I was too shy to go up and talk to people.
I got Linda Addison's
autograph.
Thank you.
I was about to repeat signature like that was going to help. But I, other than talking to Marshall Lakes, the artist, and John Jennings, obviously, I don't think I really talked to anybody else. I mean, I asked a couple people a couple questions, but never really tried to initiate conversation because I felt like my knowledge was inadequate.
I got to talk to, his name was Andre, I don't remember his last name, but he was a artist,
mm-hmm.
and when I was showing him the way to the very far away food.
Yes, the very far away food.
We talked about Kindred, And he had never read it. Oh. He'd never read the graphic novel. He'd never read the book. He had been gifted the graphic novel and didn't realize it until he was listening to our interview. Oh. And I was like, no, you need to go read it. And yeah. He was like, this sounds really intense, but yeah, I need to go read it.
So after the Octavia E. Butler panel, I went to Heroes and Shiros of Steampunk. I almost always want to say steampunk, but that is the difference, so it's very important that I emphasize that it is steampunk. And on this panel was Milton Davis, Balogun Ojetade, Valjean Jeffers, and Miss Lovelace, who was a cosplayer. She had a very in-depth established character in steampunk, and she came in that costume and she explained the background and her process of creating this character and why she cosplayed and what she got out of the experience. She is from Ohio, if I remember correctly. I do not remember, unfortunately, her character name, which is what she was going by, but her costume was great. Like, she stands out in a room because she looks phenomenal. I was very, very intrigued because never really known anyone who cosplay. I've never really seen cosplay other than pictures online. But it was really cool to know that there was a background, because a lot of people who cosplay pick established characters from an established universe, like something in Marvel or DC or, you know, whatever, video games. But this was cool because she created it. And, you know, she said it herself. She's not really an author or a writer, but there's no doubt that it's an incredibly creative process to come up with a world and a backstory for a character that you then act out and play for years. So I was pretty impressed by that. You know, it made me think of it in a different way, because I'd never really thought of people creating their own characters. But it was very exciting. But steampunk is obviously supposed to be similar to steampunk, but it focuses on black authors, but also black characters. And as we touched on in the panel, steampunk is problematic because of some symbolism and imagery of colonization and oppression. So they find it to be a pretty problematic genre, but there's so much of it that they do like. So steampunk removes those problematic racist undertones or overtones. I don't know how subtle they really are. And I mean, it's just, yes, it's like steampunk, but it's also just so unique to me. I read two works from the steampunk anthology, and it's interesting because I read Rite of Passage and I thought that Balogun Ojetade had written it, but when I brought it up at the panel, he said that he'd only written part of it, and that Milton Davis wrote the other part, so they wrote this in conjunction with one another. So this particular piece that I read is by Balogun, and it's Rite of Passage, Blood and Iron. And I was fascinated by this, but I also was clueless because it referenced so many existing characters and people from history that I didn't know. And so at first I just thought that it was like world building, like he was establishing new characters, and I just didn't know who these people were. But then I was talking about this story with my boyfriend and found out, no, John Henry was real. Obviously, I knew Harriet Tubman was real. Like, that one I knew. But, you know, it's like,
oh my gosh, I have this old, old DVD that's called American Legends, and on it, it has a John Henry one, and it's all about John Henry, and it's narrated by James Earl Jones.
Oh, cool.
It's the coolest thing.
Well, then you'll probably...
I don't know how true it is, but...
so then I'll read some of these names off and see if I was the only clueless person, since my boyfriend knew who all of these people were. And I think Dr. Yasik did as well. But John Henry, already mentioned. Victor Clemens? No, me neither. Let's see. This one, I don't know if this Sylvester Roper. No, that might be a character that was made up for the story. Well, one was Peter Pan. I knew Peter Pan. And I knew Tinkerbell.
We all know Peter Pan. Peter Pan and Tinkerbell.
Well, there was, like, a mechanical alligator. Did not realize that was actually something from Peter Pan. But apparently it is. So I probably need to re...
Please note that guest is laughing.
Noted.
Oh my God, you didn't know that.
No, apparently
I
need to.
Have you seen the movie?
20 years ago? I mean, it's one of those movies I watched once in my life when I was...
Once? You only watched it once?
5 years old.
Girl, what are you doing?
There is a Peter Pan painting hanging in my house.
That's...
But it's not mine. I did not pick that.
Oh, man.
And there's no crocodile alligator thing in it, so...
No, the mechanical alligator crocodile thing is, like, the main part. It's the whole, like, Captain
Really?
Hook. Yeah, Captain
I
Hook.
I had no idea.
The alligator took Captain Hook's hand, and so at times in the movie, you can hear the alligator getting close, the crocodile, whatever, getting closer. And
so, now are you sensing why I was so clueless when I was reading this story? And this is all on me. It's not like it was written badly. It's that I just... didn't know anything about these people other than Harriet Tubman.
As long as you know Harriet Tubman, I think you're better than you could be.
Maybe. There were more people, and I'm trying to remember, but it's a pretty long story. But anyways, I haven't encountered any more names of characters that I didn't know. So... I know you unfortunately had to leave the panel you went to early because you weren't feeling particularly well.
Nope.
And then we regrouped and, you know, got some food and some drink.
It was, really quickly, though, it was a really, really, really interesting panel. But I had never... I just saw Romance and Vampire Hunters and I was like, ooh, vampires, cool. Because I loved Fledgling and I was just like... It sparked my interest in vampires because I hadn't liked vampires before Fledgling. And it was about L.A. Banks, who started as a romance writer and then just kind of became a sci-fi writer. And I don't know, she sounded really cool. Okay. I wish I had known more about her going into the panel.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm going to have to look her up. Sounds interesting.
Definitely. But everybody there, kind of like how people were talking about Octavia E. Butler, people were talking about L.A. Banks in a very like similar way. It's sad that... I've never heard of any of them, and, like, so many people have never heard of any of them, but it's also really cool to know that they do exist out there. Like, really amazing people that just need more attention.
So, I only went to 3 panels, even though there were many, but it was...
But we went to the third one together.
We went to the third one together, and it was Women in Black Speculative Fiction.
Marsha was so funny. There were 5 people there, and then another person walked in, and they were like, oh, here, sit down. And then another person walked in, the moderator gave up her chair, and another person walked in, and there were, like, all these amazing women just sitting there talking about women in black speculative fiction. It was the coolest thing.
They had the room number wrong, and so I think that the room they ended up in could not accommodate how many people were actually on this panel.
But also, I think some of them just walked in and were like, I'm gonna talk on this panel, even though I'm not...
I don't know. I kind of thought...
I think that's what happened. No?
I'm going to look it up. It was Nicole Givens-Kurtz. And then Linda Addison, Cherie Renee Thomas, Valjean Jeffers, Kenesha Williams, Christine Taylor Butler, Kimber, Susanna Morris, who is a professor at Georgia Tech.
My professor. She's amazing.
Shout out to Susanna Morris. And Violet Meyer.
Oh, yeah. No, they were all supposed to be there, and they just didn't have a big enough room.
So that's 10 people?
Well, we made room.
I mean, the topic of this, kind of about the state of black women in speculative fiction and their role in not only being authors, but in being editors and making it past editing and focus groups. So, I mean, this was a diverse panel because there were some young adult authors. Linda Addison writes horror. Cherie Renee Thomas is primarily an editor of anthologies. She's really well known for her anthology, Dark Matter, mm-hmm. which was the first anthology of Black speculative fiction.
Yep.
Pretty important.
Which is a big deal. It's a big deal, and also, like, how did it take so long for that to happen?
I know, because it came out in, what, like, 2000? Mm-hmm. Like, that's not that long ago. Mm-hmm. I guess that's almost 20 years ago, but it doesn't seem like that long ago. And in 2001, it won the World Fantasy Award for Best Anthology. Like I said, there were children's authors, young adult authors, editors, horror writers, and then Dr. Susanna Morris, I think, is primarily an academic writer. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was a diverse panel of Black women in speculative fiction, whether they all came at it in different angles, from different angles, because, I mean, why wouldn't they? They write different things, they study it in different ways, but it was a very intriguing conversation of how to get up in the industry, how to get your work out there, whether or not you should open a door and hold it open for the woman behind you, whether or not you should just put it out there yourself, just the different ways that you can accomplish what you want to, and if there is a better way, or if any way that gets you out there is the best way.
Yeah. They also talked a little bit about, I remember this specifically, about how, you know, I don't know how to say it without sounding, like, awful, but they were talking about how, like, they are the lowest on, like, the hierarchy of, like, power, because, like, in our culture, women are lower.
Yeah.
And in our culture, Black people are put lower, and they shouldn't be. So, like, while they are doing all this stuff and they have accomplished so much, they need allies, they need people who can, like, give them a voice, too. You know, I don't want to say there's only so much that they can do, but, like, if there's something good out there, you need to tell someone about it, you know? And so we need to tell by, you know, this podcast and, like, other people who hear it, we need to tell people that, like, these people are out there. If you haven't heard about them, go find them out. Go find them, because they're amazing. Like, I have a list of, like, 20 things that I need to buy now, because I want to read them. Like, I went to... We'll get there later, but, like, the next panel I have, like, there are 3 new people that I need to buy books from because they're so great.
Well, we can talk about that. I forgot you went to another panel. I left.
Yeah, yeah.
So what panel did you go to?
So I went to world building and sci-fi and fantasy because mm-hmm. I'm doing research and I don't know how to world build because I don't know how to write creatively. and so they talked about, you know, each author had a different perspective on where you need to start your world building. So, and then what do you do once you've started, and, like, what's your specific thing that you focus on when you're creating your story? So, the 3 people, 4 people, just kidding, there.
Okay.
We had L.M. Davis, Marcus Haynes, and Gerald Coleman. Yeah, they were, like, the 3 authors we were talking to. And then Milton Davis was sitting next to them, kind of, like...
keeping the conversation flowing.
Yeah, yeah. It was really funny. So L.M. Davis and Milton Davis have the same last name, but Milton Davis always, like, introduces himself first, so L.M. Davis is always, like, no relation. It was just really funny. They, like, had already, like, known each other and everything, and they had a really funny banter going on. It was just funny. So, yeah, they talked about, like, their 3 main things that they do whenever they're world building. So, Gerald Coleman mostly said that he focused on, like, a map, sort of. And this is overgeneralization of what they talked about. And then all 3 of them were, like, know your genre. Know your genre. And then...
and write science fiction with a purpose.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Marcus Haynes said that he mostly focuses on the characters and then writes the story. And then L.M. said that she usually sticks with, you know the rules of your world and then write your story. It was really interesting how the 3 of them had what seemed like really different approaches, but then the more they talked, the more similar they became. And they were like, I don't know, it's just really interesting.
And maybe do a combination.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to have rules for your world. You've got to maintain those rules. You can't break those rules, mm-hmm. or else your plausibility fails.
Yeah, and as a huge fantasy fan, gotta have a map. You gotta have a map. Dr. Morris and I agree with her, but she's always like, if there's a map, it's for me in the beginning of the book, and it's really
so. Or if there's a glossary. Are you guys really into Dora the Explorer then? They have a map.
I'm walking out. Bye guys, podcast's over. I'm out of here.
That was just the
actually,
first
that was my show.
Came to my head.
That was actually legitimately my show.
Now you're going to be listening to the wonderful interview. And it is wonderful, not because of me and Jessica, because we are awkward individuals who don't know how to interview someone.
In case you haven't noticed yet.
but John Jennings was the most sincere,
humble,
genuine, sweet person I think I've ever met. And
talented.
He made me tear up.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
During the panel. I know you both were tearing up during the interview.
Mm-hmm. Chills covered the entire body the whole time, just talking about Octavia Butler. And
but he feels it so deeply, and it makes me feel it so deeply.
Absolutely.
So, on that note, please enjoy this this interview with John Jennings. Let us know what you think. So, we're going to be signing off. I'm your host, Harper, and with me is my guest host,
Jessica.
And I hope you enjoy the interview.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.
My name is John Jennings, and I am a professor of media and cultural studies at the University of California at Riverside.
Okay, so we both just read the adaptation of Kindred mm-hmm. yesterday.
Oh.
And like sped through it because it was amazing.
That means so much to me.
Thank you. As a graphic novel lover, I am like, I couldn't put it down. My roommate was home, and I was like, no, you gotta go away. I'm busy.
Seriously?
Really.
You're going to make me tear up, man. Seriously, that's awesome.
Okay. I've never read a graphic novel, but I read a Nancy Drew graphic novel mm-hmm. as a child. Mm-hmm. But this was my first, like, non-Nancy Drew one, and it was phenomenal.
Thank you.
I've never read the original Kindred, right. So this was my first introduction into Octavia E. Butler.
What? Yeah.
And
wow.
And now I just want it all.
And that's great. Oh, yeah, we're working on two more adaptations now, The Parable of the Sower and The Parable of the Talents back to back.
Okay.
So those are our next. We haven't really announced it either, so.
That's really exciting.
We'll be keeping our eyes on.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to. Yeah, we're working on it. And there's a soft cover of the Kindred book dropping in July.
Okay.
July, and then it's getting translated into French, so.
That's so exciting as well.
Yeah, we're excited. Yeah, no, it's great. It's been really wonderful and quite an honor. And right now, it's nominated for an Eisner Award, actually. So we're excited about that too.
Really cool.
So we'll find out if we win or not, like at San Diego Comic Con.
Okay.
That's when they give out the Eisner. So
that's this summer, right?
This summer. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, yep. Good luck.
Thank you. I'm excited. I'm trying not to think about it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's so great to win an Eisner for that. You know, so because we're up against. You know, H.P. Lovecraft adaptation, which, you know, a very problematic gentleman. I'm a fan of his, you know, it's difficult, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I really like his work, but also I know the politics behind it. And you know,
it's a lot of people, though, in the industry. There's so many.
Yeah. And then also there's a Moby Dick adaptation. There's a Beowulf adaptation. So I was like, we're going up against some interesting things.
Yeah.
So we'll see, because it's in the adaptation category. So,
okay.
Anyway, but yeah, let me stop. But yeah, thank you so much. That means so we worked very hard on it. Yeah, I think we probably shaved a year off our lives working on it because we like turned it around so fast.
How long did it take you?
Let's see, totally, I think we probably pulled it off in like about 10, 11 months or something
okay.
like that.
Okay, wow, that's impressive.
Yeah, I think insane. If we think about it, like when we really started working on it, because there was a lot of hiccups at the beginning with the editorial side. And yeah, it took them 5 months to get the rights from the estate, you know, just to work out the details. But yeah, once we started working on it, I think we turned it around, about 11 months or so, as I recall. There's a lot of, like, not sleeping.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. So I have some general questions on your background.
Sure.
So can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Okay. Let's see. So currently I am a professor in the Department of Media and Cultural Studies, a fairly new program at University of California, Riverside. Very interdisciplinary. A lot of us are artists and writers and editors who basically combine cultural studies with media studies. And so it's super political. It's a really awesome program. It's a very diverse student population. That's what maybe attracted me to the program. For 20 years, though, I was a graphic design teacher.
Okay. You know,
so a professor of design. Teach applied semiotics, design history, design methodology on undergrad and graduate levels, illustration, image making. You know, so a lot of the work that I do is like illustration based. But basically, I used to train designers how to use images in their work, essentially. You know, and when I was at Jackson State, I actually was, I pretty much created their graphic design program, you know, just in the modern state. So, yeah, SUNY Buffalo, I did like a lot of more research-oriented work. So basically before then, before UCR, I taught at University of Buffalo, SUNY, and before that, University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. That's where I got tenure. I was there for like 8 years.
Okay.
Before that, Jackson State University. So most of my career has been as an illustrator and artist and a design teacher and mentor to designers. And I think what happened was I just kind of got, I was disenchanted a little bit with the design industry and wanted to kind of shake things up career-wise. Mm-hmm. And I became really interested in like identity politics and how they get mediated through images. And so I kind of shifted over to media studies. And yeah, so that's my story and I'm sticking to it. There you go. Yeah, so as far as like where I'm from Mississippi originally. I was trained in commercial art, which is like the great granddaddy of graphic design. And with a minor in drawing. And then I got my first master's in 95 in art education at University of Illinois, and then an MFA in studio design. I always with a focus on cultural studies and just the context of identity and images. So that's kind of what led me down the path. But I've always been a huge comics fan. So I did like my thesis, like my graduate thesis work on comics and design work. So I've always been interested in storytelling in that medium.
Which comics did you do your dissertation on?
Let's see. Actually, I used Scott McCloud's Understanding Comics as kind of a framework, but I made my own comic.
Okay.
It was called Spook.
That's really cool.
It was kind of like this kind of revenge fantasy story. It's embarrassing now.
Why?
No, because it's so bad.
It sounds good.
It was cool. You know, it was all right. But yes, I was working. So yes, I did created my own story.
Okay.
And just kind of was looking at like how design kind of can help with like graphic storytelling. So.
And that was for your MFA, you were saying?
Yeah, it was my MFA. Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's really exciting. Mm-hmm. So another question was, how were you first introduced to science fiction, to this genre?
Through my mom.
Okay.
Yeah, my mother was a literature major as well at Alcorn State University in Mississippi, and she didn't finish, unfortunately, because you know she got pregnant with me. And so she dropped out of school.
I was like, mom too.
But she ended up, she had all her books and stuff too. And she was always a huge fan of like science fiction and fantasy and things of that nature. So I started reading speculative fiction super early, you know. So stuff like Edgar Allan Poe and Isaac Asimov. Mm-hmm. And like I was reading super early. It was crazy. And as you know, I grew up in the sticks. I was way back in the country. And this is before anything. You know, there was no MTV, there was no internet. It's just
right.
It's just your imagination, you know. So yeah, I started reading very early. Like I think my first explorations into the fantastic were like mythology, you know, like Greek mythology, Roman mythology, African mythology, you know, Chinese mythology, and then how that starts to segue into pop culture and things of that nature. So yep, that's kind of like where I started with my mom.
Yeah. So. I guess the same for me with my dad. Mm-hmm. I think it's always someone close to you that gets interested in
you're
the
like,
genre.
Check this out. You're like, ooh, this is crazy.
Yep.
Asimov
was really big with my brothers and my dad, the Foundation series.
The Foundation series, yep, exactly. Ray Bradbury's work, The Martian Chronicles, was a really foundational for me too. Heinlein stuff I liked a lot actually early on. And ironically, I didn't come across Butler until like much later. Because they didn't teach her in my, you know, in my literature classes at the HBCU that I went to. It was mostly Harlem Renaissance work, traditional, you know, black writers. You know.
W.E.B. Du Bois.
Of course, yeah. Who who wrote science fiction, actually. Yeah. So that's like, yeah, it's like, they didn't even talk about those pieces, though, right? They talked about, you know, more of his political work, but as a sociologist. Yeah. But no, but he wrote sci-fi, actually.
The Comet, yeah.
The Comet and The Princess Steel, which was found 3 years ago.
Okay, I haven't read that one.
No, it hadn't been released yet.
Okay.
Yeah. It's like they found it 3 years ago. It's going to be in a collection of his new work. Well, not his new work. It's work from his archives that are in other genres. So he wrote romance stories. He wrote like adventure stories, all kinds of stuff.
Wow. Who first came up with the idea to do an adaptation of Kindred?
Oh, that would be Abrams Comic Arts.
Okay. I didn't know if day you were just like...
Nope, it doesn't work that way. It's funny because we always get that question. Actually, that's not true. It was probably Beacon Press. Okay. Beacon Press, who they have control over Octavia Butler's... her work, you know, they actually have a contract with her at Beacon Press. So they wanted to do an adaptation of Kindred in the late... Well, it was like maybe 2008-ish.
Okay.
And Damian Duffy, you know, my longtime partner for the last 15 years, it's crazy. He came across this call for entries for a, you know, an adaptation of it then. And we hurriedly got in a proposal. We totally failed to get that opportunity then. And another artist got that opportunity. For some reason, that version of it never happened. And then it circles back around like 2012 or so. And I'm at Comic-Con showing pages from comics that I want to try to get published. And Sheila Keenan, who then was the senior editor of Abrams Comic Arts, really liked my work. I was very, very gracious about, you know, what I was doing. And she said that I would be perfect for this book she's trying to get done. And I was like, well, what book is that? And she's like, Octavia Butler's Kindred. And I was like, excuse me? Because then I thought like, oh yeah, that's right. This other book never came out. I was like, so I didn't know what happened. So I was like, okay. So I told Damien that we had this opportunity to maybe do this. So 5 months later, we're signing a contract. So honestly, if I had had my druthers, I probably would have done Wild Seed. You know, Wild Seed is my favorite Octavia Butler story. It's what introduced me to her work. But Kindred is beloved because it cuts into so many different genres of work, you know, women's studies, you know, it's a fictional history piece, you know, it's all kinds of interesting things happening with that story. I get it. And you know, she's extremely widely read. I think, and I hope I'm not making this up, I think she actually is the most successful black female writer of all time, you know, as far as like sales. You know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, so that's how it happened. So they were like, this book should go first because it was like the most beloved and successful and, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's gut-wrenching. But it's like, yeah. But it's like, what is going on with this book? Oh, you know?
Yeah.
So that's how we ended up doing it with Abrams. And it was interesting because I was just telling Sheree about this earlier. Michael Jacobs, the CEO of Abrams, he was taking a night class, I think, in English literature.
Okay.
Which, let's just kind of look at this like a CEO of a multinational company taking a night class
right.
in English. And it was on their reading list.
Okay.
Right? And so that's how he came across it. He was like, he had never seen it before. And then we're talking about someone who's probably been publishing for like 20 years or so.
Right.
Like, what is this book? And then Sheila Keenan, who's been, she's been in publishing around the same amount of time, had just come across it too. So it just goes to show you just how like fringe certain elements of publishing are. And then, you know, how when the right people read this stuff, they're like, what is going on with this book? So they acquired the rights to it. So,
okay.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, but it happened simultaneously.
Yeah.
It's weird how that works out.
That's insane.
Yeah. Okay.
Did you have less creative freedom adapting Kindred because so many people do love it? Did you feel like pressure to do it a certain way?
I felt a lot of pressure. Not necessarily to do it a certain way. We tried, I guess the only way we were really concerned with was her voice. Because really, you know, I love the fact that she's still listed as the author instead of like we adapted it, but I felt like we were in collaboration with Octavia Butler, you know what I'm saying? And I love that idea. Like, I felt like we were desperately trying to make sure that we found the core of the story that she was trying to tell, you know?
Yeah.
So we did a lot of research on what her intentions. We did a lot of research on what she thought the characters would look like. We tried to be as detail-oriented as possible, but bring our own spin to it. And as you were saying, I mean, and thank you again for the praise for the book, but, you know, we wanted to cut away, you know, the things that weren't necessary for the graphic novels, per se, which was very difficult. Sheila Keenan was a great editor for that. She was like, we don't need this part. I know it's hard. We didn't want to cut anything. But she was great. Like, so really, Sheila should be a collab. Like, she's our editor, but she should be on the cover too, because there was a lot of decisions that we just couldn't make because we were just afraid to cut anything that she wrote.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, it was painful, but it was like it worked out, because there are certain affordances that comic books have that literature doesn't have, you know, and love and vice versa, right? So we were just trying to make sure that we got the best out of the core of the story. So that was the main pressure. Yes, and, you know, you think Beyonce got some rabid fans. Oh, Lord. Man. Let me tell you, like, the butlerarians, or whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
They're like, look, seriously, we got a lot of flack just for being men. And then, you know, Damien's white. So it's like, you got a white man adapting this chair, you know,
yeah.
The optics of it are kind of skewed, right? And then, you know, we have a white woman editing, but we loved the work so much that it comes through. And I think when people sit down and talk to us about the story, that I think they realize, like, no, we were serious. We're not trying to say, this is our story. Yeah, a lot of people said, oh, well, why did you want to adapt this story? It's like, no, it chose us.
Yeah.
We would have this chance to do it before, and we didn't, and we missed it, and it circled back around to us. And I was like, well, obviously this story wants us to do this. Mm-hmm. I know it sounds weird, but, you know.
Meant to be,
exactly, yeah.
Well, I loved how you really could tell that it was still Octavia Butler's story, because I've read Fledgling, and that's the only one I've read.
Yeah,
but I could feel that, like...
Ooh, no, I don't know if they
I was up until 5 a.m. reading it, because I was reading it for class, and I was like, it was like Saturday morning, or Sunday morning, I guess, until 5 a.m. I had to finish it. I was like, what's happening?
Right, a master of the craft of writing, and when we lost her, we lost a treasure.
Yeah.
So. I just got really.
Me too.
I'm sorry.
Me too.
I'm
sorry. My teacher.
I don't
want
to even like. Yes, I'm. It makes my heart hurt to think about how she passed away. And oh my God. Anyway, sorry. Let's not talk about that. Oh, okay.
You've talked a lot about your background, so this might have a little bit of overlap. But like, were there any inspirations to your graphic novel style? Like your.
Oh, for that particular one.
Well, not necessarily for that particular one, but are there any like. Graphic novels or comics that really influenced your style?
I'm really influenced by a lot of printmaking work, like people like Lynn Ward, Franz Masriel. Kathy Kollwitz was a huge inspiration for this particular piece because of her work with the Holocaust. You know, she was a German woodcut and fine artist, and she had a really amazing style to deal with that kind of work. Palma Hayden, Otto Dix. Actually, a lot of my influences are fine art, you know? So my style as a graphic novelist comes a lot more from like fine art and expressionist, surrealist backgrounds. That's what attracts me. So my hand is really, it's almost like a printmaker's hand. Like my mentor, God rest him, Tom Kovacs, was a Polish printmaker. And I studied under him in grad school. And so a lot of my inspirations come from that kind of aesthetic. So. For comics, I'm really inspired by Ted McKeever, Dennis Cowan, Bill Sienkiewicz, people like that who had more of an arts kind of feel to it. Dave McKean, Colleen Duran, but even like, you know, storytelling wise, people like Wendy Pini, you know, those are the people I was really, of course, like Will Eisner, of course, you can't, you know, anybody that's studying, that's looking at like comics, you owe everything to Will Eisner. And honestly, Frank Miller, I don't agree with that gentleman's politics, but that dude is a great storyteller. And he has a wonderful, wonderful hand, you know? So, yeah. So I think you can see I wear my influences on in the hand. You can see if you know the antecedents, you can see who I look at, you know? Yeah.
As you were explaining, I was like, yeah, I see that. Mm-hmm. I get it. Yeah.
Even the way that I inked Kindred, I wanted to work with something that was difficult to work with, so the entire book is drawn in Sharpie.
Okay.
Wow.
I was going to ask if it was digital or not.
It was digital, too, but it's like everything has to be digital these days. Just about. But no, but the originals are, there's originals.
Okay.
Like 720 drawings, actually, that are now at the archive that I just told you about. I donated them to my new school. The entire, like most of the drawings for it are in the science fiction archive. And so they're all Sharpie inks, you know.
That's really cool.
That's crazy. Really impressive.
Yeah, I was getting, it was getting loopy late at night.
It's like
like
my wife would come into my studio and be like, "Are you okay?" Oh, I'm like, "I see three of you. Maybe the one in the middle." It was like very. It was crazy.
Sleep deprived. Yeah, sleep and sniffing. High on, yeah. And high on the Sharpies. Yeah, like, I don't even know what's in them, but
I know it's like nothing. Probably nothing good. No, like I said, we probably shaved off a life of our, you know, year of our life. Like Doctor Who, like he would just shave up a life. You know? Yeah. That's how I felt. It was like, okay, well, we have dedicated a year of our actual life for real.
Oh man.
Hallucinations. It's nuts. Oh, anyway, no, I can't even tell you the things that we would do to get this book done. It was brutal. But it was worth it because people love it. People seem to really love it. We were so afraid when it came. I was like, oh, God, people are going to hate this book. Oh, God. You know, it was the first time that I had done a project where there were no changes. Because I've been working as a graphic designer for like 20 years, you know. And usually the client will have something to say. They didn't have a change. They just went through this like, this is perfect. This is what we need. This is what it needs to be. And I was like, really? Seriously? Oh, okay. I'm going to go sleep now.
Maybe you should do all of your work in Sharpie in the middle of the night.
I know, I know. You know, honestly, I'm actually, for Parables, where I've switched to a totally digital output. Like, my studio's in my bed. So, yeah, I use the iPad Pro now with the iPad Pencil. I'm never turning back. It's just, you know, I've just been practicing with it. So I
must health risks.
Yeah.
And also, you know, the affordances of it. Like, I can do fully rendered work on an airplane. Like, I did the stuff, I'll show you some stuff I did on my plane. It's crazy. Like, you know, there's no bumps, you know. Yeah. Even if it is, I mean, you can undo as much as you want. It's amazing. So, I think that might be the last seriously, like, you know, analog piece I might do for comics, I'll have to say. You know, I hate to let it go, but it doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah.
Particularly if you're working on it. I mean, Aunt Kindred is over 237 pages?
Yeah.
The next one is going to be like 266 pages probably, and then more. Yeah. It's like, you know, almost 300 page books. I got to do something that's better, you know. And then also too, I learned a lot from production of the book too. I'm used to doing stuff that's you know, by myself, you know, and I'm used to handling all, and I was doing all the artwork. So really interesting. You didn't ask this question, but like, you know, people understand how difficult a medium is, and comics is a very difficult medium. And so by the time I got done with all the inks, you know, and finished it, I had injured myself. I actually had a pinched nerve in my shoulder because of just the moving of the mouse. And I looked into my folder of uncolored pieces, and it was like a sea of uncolored pages. And you could probably tell I'm a pretty jovial person, right? I despaired. That was the first. I felt like I'm going to let everybody down. I looked because I used math actually, and I counted out how long it would take me to do these pages. And I looked at our timeline. I was like, "There's no way I can finish this by myself." And I was just like, "Oh my God, I'm going to fail this. There's no way." So I had to actually go to Florida for a. I was doing a consultation on a dance. I do some stuff with theater and stuff too. And I used the money from that trip. It actually cleared my head. And I was like, you know what? I want to pay color assistance. So I paid what they call flatters. So they'd come in and they do the flat colors for me, send me the flats, and then I do the renderings. And so I went from 5 pages a day to 13 pages a day. And we colored that entire book in about 3 weeks.
Wow.
The end. And I was like, okay. So now that we understand that we need to do this in a studio style, This should go a lot better, but it's a learning curve. So I have my flatters. I was working with 5 flatters, and we would work around the clock. And what I did is I became a project manager in the middle of the project. So I said, okay, well, you do the night scenes, you do the interiors, you do that. You know what I'm saying? And so they had, and they would send them all to me, and I go. One particular point, I was coloring stuff 3 up. So I go pop 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 pop. Next, 3 pages at a time. Next, yeah, it was like blah. It was crazy. And so once we were rocking and rolling, it was done. Had to get it done. So, you know, and I'm just grateful that people love it, you know what I'm saying? For the most part, people love it. You know, I think it's been highly rated. It's crazy. So the soft cover has like 3 pages of praise, like just the, you know, responses to it. And we were like, just stuff we hadn't even seen before. So one of my favorite ones was ICVV2, and they do like a lot of graphic novel pieces. And the dude was like, look, I barely give things a 5-star rating, but this is a 5. This is one of the best adaptations of a novel I've ever seen. And I was like,
chills,
that's
crazy.
Yeah, I did too. Yeah, seriously. Yeah, because I was like, you know, or seeing an A rating in Entertainment Weekly. Yeah. Or the fact that it was, you know, that it debuted at number one on a New York Times bestsellers list. I was like, holy crap. So we were like, this is actually a real thing. Seriously.
That's through pre-sales? Is that how that
works? That's right. That's right. Look at you with the pre-sales. yeah, and so now to be the first African American man to win a Bram Stoker Award for working on this book. Then right after me, Jordan Peele for Get Out. So it was like, bam, bam, we get win them in the same night. So I was first, and then he came, and he was later. I was like, that's crazy. But for a long time, Linda Addison was the only African American, you know, to have won a Bram Stoker Award. So it's been really amazing, and I'm hoping that we can carry that kind of energy into Parable. So far, so good. Damien is an excellent partner and writer. And we are very conscientious about the content of the work. Mm. I'm very serious about it.
It shows through. Yeah.
Thank you. And understand that this is beloved to people. That people want these books to be spectacular. So we put in blood, sweat, and tears into it. You know. So.
Literally.
Yeah.
And hallucinations.
Yeah.
There were hallucinations. I ain't gonna lie. I'm not even making that up.
Yeah. You know? I believe you.
Yeah.
It sounds like a stressful but rewarding time.
It's like a lot of pain and suffering
with
a lot of reward. You're right. Because comics are like a very unforgiving medium, you know. But they also love you too. But you know, Jack Kirby said, he said, comics will break your heart. I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
Can you just stop for a minute and say that, like, you won the Bram Stoker Award with Jordan Peele on the same day?
In the same night.
In the same night?
That's
awesome. Okay.
He's great, too, by the way. I met him a few months ago, and I was there when he got his Bram Stoker.
Yeah.
It arrived in the mail the same day I was there. He's like, well, I just came in. It was
crazy.
Pretty dumb.
Yeah. That's crazy. I love watching, like, interviews with him talking about, like, Get Out and then, like, his Key and Peele days and all that stuff.
Yes. Yeah.
He seems like such a cool dude.
He is. He's a very good dude. Yeah.
But this interview's about you, sorry.
Okay.
No, you're fine. It didn't occur to me that it would be horror genre. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's horrifying, but like what happens in it, not your work, obviously.
Well, yeah, no. No, you're right, because it actually does have the trappings of more of a gothic horror piece, right? Even down to the tropes. It's got body horror, it got this weird like love triangle thing happening. It's like you know, there's a doppelganger, because the idea of the twin is something like twinning and the uncanny, you know. She's time traveling because of some kind of supernatural connection. It's not science fictiony, it's actually some kind of existential connection. So these types of things, so it makes it all falls within this kind of gothic horror piece. And I made up this theoretical framework called the ethnogothic, which looks at like using gothic tropes as ways to talk about various types of oppression, particularly like racialized tension and oppression, you know. So you can see it in stuff like Get Out, or like Chaos in the Hood, or like even Beloved, or Daughters of the Dust, you know, where you're talking about the extremely complex, almost cosmically disruptive forces around racialized, you know, oppression. It's unspeakable, you know, these types of things. Like the types of things you have to actually like deal with to actually create a slave or blackness or whiteness or whatever. It's not, they don't exist. They're magical, and they don't exist. But we base so many things around it. And these stories, like, you know, Octavia Butler's work, they're so effective as apparatuses or technologies to talk about. I look at stories like technologies. They're like extensions of ourselves to explain the unexplainable, right? That's mythology, you know? So these are the things I think about a lot in my own work, and I try to bring it to the graphic, you know, because how do you actually use the visceral nature of graphic images to get across the complexities of how we relate to each other? These are the things that I'm fascinated by as a creator and as a teacher. So,
going to your teaching for a moment, I was curious what kinds of classes you teach currently.
So, right now, I'm a full professor of media studies, so I pretty much create my own class. I only teach the things that I write. Right now, I'm teaching a comics and contemporary culture class. I mean, not right now, but I do. and three classes on Afrofuturism. One is visual culture. It's like almost like an intro to Afrofuturist aesthetics course, you know, that kind of thing. Afrofuturism and the visual cultures of horror, and also Afrofuturism and sequential art and comics.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I know.
I took Afrofuturism last semester with Dr. Morris.
Oh, Susanna's great.
Yeah, it was so much fun. And that's where I read Fledgling and watched Get Out.
She's one of my favorite people. Like, she's truly brilliant, brilliant woman. I hope she hears this.
She's just,
yeah, oh, no, yeah. She's
well, I'll make sure she listens.
She's one of my favorite people. And she's truly brilliant and extremely courageous. And I really admire Susanna. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's great. And has been really supportive of my work. And I really appreciate that, too. You know, she's one of the people that I call to get counseling on to make sure I'm doing something right. You know? That's seriously. So cool. Yeah.
She's pretty awesome.
Yeah, she is pretty awesome.
She's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
I haven't done much research into Afrofuturism, but mm-hmm. last night I read some steampunk.
Oh, yeah, steampunk. Yeah,
from the steampunk anthology.
Yeah, that's the Milton. Mm-hmm. And them did. Yeah.
And so I read one of his, The Rite of Passage.
Mm-hmm.
They were fantastic. Mm-hmm. And the artwork, the cover work that, I love
it. It's very striking, very beautiful work. Yep. No, but Milton is a huge force in this movement of like black speculative culture, so... And I hope people realize that. So, since we're talking about Octavia Butler's work, I think that there really isn't a measure to how much influence and inspiration that woman gave to the world. You know, so I just want to leave it at that. Like, I wish I could have met her. Mm-hmm. So, she seemed like an amazing person. So, mm-hmm. and her work was substantial and life changing. So,
absolutely.